from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush lifted controversial tariffs on steel imports today, 16 months ahead of schedule and under huge pressure from U.S. trading partners. In an Oval Office photo session with Jordan's King Abdullah, the president gave this rationale for his trade policy reversal.
The decision I make will be based upon my strong belief that America's consumers, the American economy is better off with a world that trades freely and a world that trades fairly.
The EU, Japan, and South Korea had threatened a trade war with the EU alone, vowing to place $2.2 billion in retaliatory tariffs on key American exports from oranges to pajamas if the American steel tariffs were not lifted. President Bush's turnaround on steel has roiled Washington, embittering steel producers and encouraging steel-consuming industries that have been hit by higher steel costs. And then there are the politics. Tonight on Point, the inside story of the steel tariff turnaround. We begin in Washington, where Mike Allen, White House reporter for The Washington Post, has been following the steel tariff story. I asked him if, after all the recent hints, there were any surprises in the president's move today.
There isn't. There was not a lot of drama about this. The president had been headed this way for some time, and the administration had been sort of signaling this to the steel makers. Now, though, we have a great drama ahead of us. The White House is unsure just how ferocious the reaction to this is going to be in states where steel matters a lot. The ones at the top of the list, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio, not coincidentally, as you know, those are also states that are at the top of the list of the most sensitive states in the 2004 election.
The president said today that the tariffs had done their work and it was time on balance to take them away. The EU said we forced Washington to do this by threatening retaliation. What's the truth here?
Well, this is a time-honored technique, is to declare victory and walk away. The president's staff does feel strongly that the steel manufacturers had a chance to consolidate, to make some of the changes, to get some breathing space, was the way the administration described this at the time they announced it, to sort of get back on their feet. The steel makers, however, say that they had did everything the administration wanted, including making the investments that they were supposed to, but they'd been promised a three-year horizon, and predictability is very important in business, and so they say that they feel a little betrayed today.
So what is the health of the steel industry today?
The health of the steel industry, it's like in the manufacturing sector, where efficiency is tough on jobs, and this consolidation, which while it makes the steel companies healthier, it results in fewer jobs. And this is an industry where whole towns revolve around it, and there aren't that many of those anymore. Now, the other side of this coin, though, is steel users, automakers, tool makers, especially in Michigan. Now, they say that they've been suffering because of this. Centers from Tennessee will tell you that there's whole businesses that have shut down there because they can't afford to buy the steel or can't compete with other makers who can buy their steel more cheaply.
Because the tariffs made steel more expensive for U.S. consumers of steel.
Precisely.
So they were putting pressure on the president. He had famously lunch in Pittsburgh this week, but the day before he was in Michigan and surely heard there from automakers saying, give us some relief from these tariffs, these high steel costs.
That's right. The president sort of saw the two ends of this axis this week in Michigan, where he did an economic event at a business that, of course, uses steel. And then, as you know, in Tuesday in Pittsburgh, he was at a fundraising reception where one of the biggest organizers was Tom Usher, the head of U.S. Steel. So you can imagine there was a little awkward lunchtime conversation there.
So how finely calculated was this as a political move for the president when he first imposed the tariff? And how do you think the White House is toting up the political impact of this now?
Well, the way that this has been written by some people is a decision that was made for political reasons that wound up being politically costly. What the administration will tell you is that they did something that they had to do at the time, but now they're going to try and make up for it by there were a number of little concessions to the industry that were announced today, and the feeling among the president's advisors is that this is something that they can survive, that there's no state where the result will change solely because of this decision that these effects are localized, and yes, there will be some very negative coverage. But what would have been worse would be to have thrown a whole bunch of new states into the mix by having a retaliation from Europe or Asia. Here you're talking Florida, a state you're very concerned about, and even a state like South Carolina that now the president has no need to pay attention to. But if there suddenly were retaliations against trade in textile goods, then you would have a whole bunch of other states where you would have this same problem. So it would just have geometrically increased their political problems.
So when the EU said, we're going to come after you, and they had very carefully tailored tariffs in mind that would have hit products in states politically important to George Bush. So they said, we're coming after you on things from oranges to pajamas. That would have been more difficult for Bush than just dealing with the steel-producing states.
And you might not lose a steel state because of this. You might lose Florida because of this. That was the sort of calculation that they made.
What are you hearing from the steel industry about the road ahead now? They expected 16 months more of protection. They won't have it. The tariffs evaporate at midnight tonight. How are they poised?
Well, it's interesting. The spin travels fast in Washington, and today the industry is saying, well, the effects might not be that bad. And I'm like, now they tell us. But steelmakers say that this is something that they believe that they can cope with. And although there is a great disappointment, there's no one saying, for instance, that they're going to go out of business or something like that. But the way that they're casting it is as a broken promise. And you're hearing a lot of lawmakers, even some Republicans from these steel states, who are saying today that the administration went back on its word.
Broken promises and real politic. Mike Allen, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
Mike Allen is White House reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with us from Washington. We're talking tonight about American steel and President Bush's lifting of steel tariffs. Did President Bush make the right decision on steel? With the EU threatening tariffs on everything from oranges to PJs, did the president have a choice? Is there still a place for tariff protection of U.S. industries? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to hear in a moment from two of the combatants in the steel tariff battle, but first, a little context. Joining me now from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, is John Hinshaw, assistant professor of history at Lebanon Valley College and author of Steel and Steel Workers, Race and Class Struggle in 20th Century Pittsburgh. Good evening and welcome, Professor Hinshaw.
Good evening, Tom.
Hi, thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
John Hinshaw, put this day in perspective for us. Give us a little, well, I guess first, feedback from, you're right there in Lebanon, a town I know. It's full of great mansions built by captains of steel industry in the old days. What was the response that you were hearing today around town to President Bush's backtracking or early dropping of the protective steel tariffs?
Well, I think a lot of Pennsylvanians are going to see it as President Bush going back on his word. There's thousands of steelworkers, and there's tens and even hundreds of thousands of retirees who this is going to hit pretty hard.
Retirees because there are many pensions that still depend on a steel industry that's up and functioning to pay those retirement benefits.
Right, and that was actually part of the when the United Steelworkers were pushing for protection in the spring of 2002. A big part of the push was for the government to come in and basically take over or, you know, rectify a lot of the problems with pensions, particularly in terms of medical benefits.
John Hinshaw, you know the history of this industry, its iconic standing in American industrial history. Trace for us in that long arc of steel where the U.S. industry is today. As I understand, what in the 70s there were more than 500,000 steel workers, now maybe 150,000. But paint the picture for us of where this industry was and where it is.
Well, I guess the way I would put it is that there's only in relatively recent times has there been even something like a free market in steel. And even now, I would say it's not a free market in steel. Throughout the whole 19th century, of course, there's very, very strong protection tariff-wise for the steel industry. And steel in the 20th century develops and then declines as part of the military-industrial complex. In the days where basically having a strong military meant having a big navy, being able to throw a lot of to bombard towns, to be able to throw a lot of shells, steel was very, very integral to the navy, to the army, and so steel just made enormous profits during World War I. U.S. Steel, which was not even the most profitable of the companies, made in the space of 2 or 3 years, in profit, it made its entire capitalization. And so, and like I said, it was one of the smaller, lower rates of profit. In World War II, government stepped in, and because companies were reluctant to build because there'd been price caps put in by the Roosevelt administration. And so government itself built about 20 to 25% of American heavy industry, and then that was handed at very favorable prices to steel companies at the end. And then Korea was really the last hurrah, and they got a lot of tax depreciations, what Fortune magazine called a lot of, you know, gravy, because a lot of these things really didn't have a military application but were just covered.
So then when Europe and Asia finally really came back from World War II, is that when the U.S. government began to support or protect the U.S. steel industry substantially again, 60s, 70s, early 80s?
I actually would say no, because at that point, the U.S. government is more interested in making sure that, you know, the so-called free world is open for business, right? I mean, and so – and all, so steel is one of the industries, like textiles, that's opened up to competition from abroad. It takes a number of years for other countries to gear up. It takes a number of years for the U.S. Industry's technology to start to decline. And a lot of what happens in the 50s is that, you know, presidents like Eisenhower is actually actively subsidizing foreign steelmakers. There's hundreds of millions of dollars that go even into Japan's steel industry.
But there were import controls in the 60s and 70s on steel.
Right. And that was put on – there's a kind of relatively brief period where it is basically a free market and the U.S. is able to compete on its own feet. And – after about 1960, the U.S. becomes a net importer of steel, and by the mid to late 60s, the steel industry, and then a little bit later, actually, the steel workers become, you know, demanding various kinds of voluntary constraints or tariff controls or import controls.
And they were fairly well-paid industrial workers for a while. How important an industry in the United States is steel today? I mean, the history is enormous, and as you say, it was front and center in the military industrial complex. But how big is it now?
Well, it's obviously not the size that it is. The industry itself is actually relatively large. It's the workforce that's really been cut to the bone. But in the peculiar world that we live in, where our pensions and our medical benefits come through our employers, it's still obviously very important for those people, for those towns, as your reporter pointed out, and then for a large number of people whose pensions and health care benefits still come through these companies. And that's where that's really where the crisis is. And in any case, you still need a steel industry to run a modern economy on.
Even the highest tech, a lot of the highest tech has steel in it somewhere, and they're still churning out cars. Jack Beatty, steel has always sat, as Professor Hinshaw points out, at this nexus of military interest, political interest, and for a long time, big, big, big dollars.
Oh, indeed. In fact, 100 years ago, next year, the biggest merger in U.S. history till that point took place, the one that created U.S. Steel. It was the first billion-dollar company. And that was a, you know, great sort of symbolic moment in American industry and indeed in the development of the American corporation. And that was the fruit, really, that steel industry that was consolidated then was partly the fruit of what John was talking about, which is the policy pursued by the Republican Party after the Civil War of trade protection. Indeed, in the 1880s, you could not get a job teaching economics at the University of Pennsylvania unless you signed a document pledging that you would not teach free trade. So this industry just didn't happen. It was built in a way, and I think what we've seen in recent years is that it's been losing, it's been unbuilt. The forces that helped to build it up are now at variance with the ideological arguments of free trade, but also with the legalities now in the World Trade Organization that work against protection.
The WTO makes a ruling, and the U.S., even George W. Bush, who doesn't like international agreements, has got to listen. We're talking tonight about American steel and the politics of protection. You can join the conversation. Did President Bush make the right decision today on steel? And with the EU threatening $2.2 billion in tariff retaliation on everything from OJ to PJs, did President Bush have a choice? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American steel and the politics of protection. Did President Bush make the right decision today on steel, ending protective tariffs 16 months ahead of schedule? Was the president right in protecting the U.S. steel industry in the first place? And after all the years of the steel industry's decline, did you know that there was still an American steel industry worth protecting? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with John Hinshaw, who joins us tonight from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He's assistant professor of history at Lebanon Valley College there. We're joined now from Washington by Gary Huffbauer. He's senior fellow at the Institute of International Economics, former deputy assistant secretary for international trade and investment policy at the U.S. Treasury Department from 1977 to 79. Good evening and welcome, Gary Huffbauer.
Thanks.
And joining us tonight from Alexandria, Virginia, Peter Morishi, professor of international business at the University of Maryland. Before joining the university, he served as the director of economics at the U.S. International Trade Commission. Good evening and welcome, Professor Morishi.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for being with us. Gary Huffbauer, to you first. What do you make of the president's move today and his implementation of protective tariffs for steel in the first place?
Well, he did the right thing today to remove these tariffs. It was a mistake back in March 2002 to put them on. They didn't really do much for the workers. They did nothing for the retirees. They did help some bondholders and creditors, and they put some more money in the pockets of the more profitable and better-run steel firms. But imports were never the problem for this industry. There is a lot of other things going on. We can go on to that in the, later on in the show. But it was done for political reasons. It was political coming in, and it's political going out. Anyway, now the politics cut the right way. They cut with the economics, and he's gotten rid of them.
But the steel industry certainly celebrated the tariffs. Without this protection, where is the U.S. steel industry headed, Gary Huffbauer?
Oh, the steel industry is in okay shape. There are three or four really big things that are going with the steel industry now which have nothing to do with the tariffs. One, the unions have dramatically reformed their work rules. Secondly, the pension load, which was very, very heavy on some of the integrated mills, that's been offloaded now to the U.S. government. Also, some creditors took a haircut, not as big as they probably should have, but they did take a haircut. The dollar is a lot more competitive now than it was in March 2002, especially against the euro and the Canadian dollar and the Japanese yen. And finally, and probably most importantly, we're out of a recession. And all those things are far more important than the tariffs ever were, and that shows up in the stock market price of the steel companies, which did not drop. In fact, they rose a little bit today.
So steel will be all right by your lights. Peter Morishi, Gary Huffbauer is a free trader, and you can hear it fully in his analysis there. What's your sense of President Bush's move today, right thing or wrong thing, and what about the tariffs in the first place?
Well, I think in the first place, the tariffs did some good. The president conditioned the tariffs on restructuring, and I think this helped bring about two things. It attracted some new capital into the industry. Remember, Wilbur Ross wasn't in the steel business when he came in, and now he is. And it took money to put together International Steel. The four largest mills, or the four largest integrated mills, are now two. Looking out into the future, the kinds of mergers that were facilitated, the improvement in the labor contracts, things of that nature, take some time to work out. If you look at other industries, for example, say the Hewlett-Packard-Compaq merger, that's just starting to yield some fruit, and we're close to 3 years there. The notion that it would take 3 years to restructure the industry, in my mind, made some sense. I think the tariffs facilitated that. Gary and I are well known to disagree on that subject. Going forward, the industry's been helped a lot by the movement of the dollar vis-a-vis the euro. There's no question about that. I think that we can agree on. Unfortunately, the Japanese yen is still pegged and hasn't moved in more than 5 years at 8.33 to a dollar.
The Chinese yuan.
The Chinese yuan.
Yeah.
Is pegged. And that means a lot of the steel industry's customers are going there because it's a good place to manufacture. By the way, steel is much more expensive in China, but labor's so cheap. And with the yuan pegged and not able to appreciate in value with the Chinese buying dollars to maintain a trade surplus, that's not helpful.
Give us a sense of what President Bush's reception must have been in Pittsburgh on Tuesday when it was already pretty well telegraphed that he was going to drop these tariffs. Did he get a cold shoulder there, or has he already given enough? Was half a loaf enough to win him support of the steel industry, to win him maybe the political support that he was fishing for when he raised the tariffs in the first place?
Oh, I think he's going to pay a political price for what he did. As I look at 2004, looking back at the electoral map of 2000, I mean, he won West Virginia, Ohio, and Indiana. And without those states, without Indiana and Ohio, he can't remain president, that the rest of the map falls about the same. I can't see why the electoral map isn't going to be equally as close. And a lot will depend on how the economy is going, how the automobile industry is going in July and August. You know, things are going great guns right now. If the economy starts to slow down in the second quarter and in the third quarter, it could be problematic for him. That's a risk he has chosen to take.
And finally, Peter Marici, on this line of thinking, what about Gary Hufbauer's assertion that imports are not the problem? Do you agree?
No, I don't think I agree with that. Imports were a problem at the time the tariff was put in place, and they could become a problem again. If the tariff had been left in place for 3 years, it would have provided a bit more certainty. It would have given more time for restructuring. The industry certainly is in better shape. It could have gotten in further better shape.
Peter, you're an advisor to an industry council, are you not?
I'm an advisor to Nucor Steel, which is a mini mill, not an integrated mill, in North Carolina.
There's a whole...
Well, that's there where their home offices are. They have plants all over the country. They're about as large as U.S. Steel in terms of the amount of steel they make.
Mm-hmm. So mini mill's a name, but it doesn't mean they're small. Gary Hufbauer, overall, just give us a sense of what portion, if you know of steel consumed in the United States is produced in the United States. What portion is imported?
Well, imports are about 20%, and that's remained much the same with fluctuations year to year. But I think the important thing I'd like to emphasize is that the mini mills, which are lean, they're run next to the customers, have been growing dramatically over the last two decades, or actually 2.5 decades.
And what is a mini mill? You're describing that in contrast to an integrated mill?
Let me just briefly describe. Yeah. It uses electricity usually to take scrap steel and make products, and the product line has dramatically increased over the last 2 decades as well. They start off with things like construction rod, but now they're mm-hmm. into flats and bars and so forth. So they're producing quite a wide range. Now, the mini mills, they don't typically have not used unionized labor. The labor force is very flexible. Usually it's paid about the same, maybe a little bit less than the unionized labor, but the main point is it's far more flexible. Secondly, they've not been loaded down with the pension burden. And third, they're located next to their customers. So the real problem in this industry in 2001 was, one, we had a recession in this economy. Secondly, we had a high dollar. But third, the mini mills were, and up for many years before, had been eating the lunch of the integrated mills. They're mm-hmm. just taking a market share because they're a more efficient segment of the industry.
So never mind the Chinese or the Koreans.
The Chinese are a much smaller. We totally disagree. China has not been a factor in the steel debate up to this point.
Peter Marici, I hear you there.
Yeah, one of the things to point out is that the mini mills don't make some of the very high-end flats that the automobile industry uses.
Flats being a kind of steel product used. Well, I don't know what a flat is.
For example, cold rolled steel is folded and becomes the structural members in an automobile.
Okay. Yep.
You don't have I-beams anymore.
Yep.
That tends to still come from integrated mills. And with regard to China, it's not so much imports from China right now, because China's importing steel much more than it's exporting.
It has its own high demand.
Mm-hmm. Rather, it's metal fabrication leaving the United States to be in China.
So that's the finished product, not the steel production.
Excuse me?
That's the finished product, not the steel production, right?
No, that's my point. What I'm getting at is users of steel are moving their production from the United States to China, and we're importing the steel indirectly.
Because that's where the further working of the materials being done. John Hinshaw, put all this in perspective for us. If only 20% of steel consumed in America is from abroad, that doesn't sound like that big a problem. Historically, is that a high number?
Well, it's an industry that needs that runs close to the margin, and it's and often the U.S. steel industry is the world's most profitable, and it's still very unprofitable compared to computers, aerospace, electronics. I guess the way that I would put it is that if you put it in a historical context, I mean, there's a number of industries and a number of sectors of the American economy which are either directly or indirectly subsidized. You know, the ones that I mentioned, aerospace, computers, electronics, a very, very large percentage of their research and development and their final product is consumed by the U.S. military. And then there's other sectors of the economy, notably the professions, which are, you know, which are basically there's a lot of barriers to entry because doctors, dentists, lawyers from, you know, Pakistan, India and Bangladesh.
So you're making a Me Too argument for steel?
Well, I think it puts steel workers in the steel industry at a competitive disadvantage if they have to go toe to toe with the Chinese, the Mexicans, the Brazilians, and you have other sectors of the economy which are basically heavily insulated, like agriculture or aerospace. And so it, you know, so basically it's a, you know, it's no way to run an economic policy for a country. It's inconsistent and it's a disservice that only manufacturing workers really have to undergo free trade. So it obviously puts pressure on wages and pensions and all the rest.
It's a wild world out there. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to invite them in. Paul's calling from Hingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, I'd like to make a comment on your discussion tonight, and I would like to tell you how it's affected my company personally.
What business are you in, Paul?
I work in a medical device company,
okay.
And we purchase vast amounts of high-grade stainless steel for implant and for surgical instrumentation.
Okay.
And we have the ability, or we used to have the ability, to purchase steel from around the world as long as it was manufactured to certain harmonized regulations like an ASTM certification.
Right, sure, okay, specs.
And now when the tariff was implemented, that in today's focus of cost cuts and making sure that you can be profitable,
yeah.
That allowed us only to buy steels from American manufacturers.
Was that a problem for you? Was it available at a reasonable price?
It was available, still available, but they took that opportunity to raise their prices. So now they basically handcuffed us because of the tariffs, and we can no longer buy German steels or Japanese steels.
What were the implications for your business, Paul?
We had to do cost cuttings other ways by streamlining processes, layoffs. So what seems to be a boon to the economy for what Bush did has had payback in other areas. So you have to pay Peter, pay Paul on this thing.
Right. So we've heard about that right across the board. Paul, thanks for your call. Gary Huffbauer, I mean, we were hearing these howls from other people, from automakers. Now, Paul tonight, a medical instrument or device maker, saying we can't afford these higher prices on steel. I mean, do we economically... on the one hand, you want to keep workers as whole and healthy as you can. On the other hand, is it really an option to set up protective barriers anymore if it's going to have that kind of flow-through effect on all kinds of other businesses?
Well, I certainly don't think so. I mean, I think his Peter pays Paul is exactly what happened in this case. We estimate a couple $1 billion was shuffled from steel users such as Paul and shuffled to the steel producers. But it was money circulating from one part of the manufacturing sector to another. Our calculations are that more jobs were lost or were not created in the steel using industry than were retained in the steel producing industry. It doesn't make any sense. Now, I've heard some people say, well, the answer was to protect the steel using firms like the medical device firm against competition from overseas. This is an absolute nonsense. I mean, this notion that we're going to protect ourselves to prosperity hasn't worked anyplace else. It's not going to work here.
Well, there it is. John's calling from Duxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Good evening. I'd like to just a very quick anecdote. I grew up in Gary, Indiana.
Yes.
And as a young boy, there were 7 major steel facilities in the Gary, East Chicago area. Today, there are 2, U.S. Steel being the most prominent of them. The others have closed. And when I was in high school in the 60s, there were 160,000 people in the city. 40,000, I remember this from learning this about state history,
yeah,
work in the steel industry.
That's astounding percentage.
Those jobs aren't there anymore. Everyone's father that I knew had a job, and most of them worked in the steel mills and made rather good pay. without college educations and so on.
So it's good pay, good jobs, and a huge portion of that economy. So what do you make of the whole tariff brouhaha today, John?
Well, I was looking at it from a political perspective, and as a person who voted for George Bush, I give him a lot of credit because he made a decision today in which he cannot win. He, if he risks losing the political states that put him in office, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and maybe Indiana, that he's made a decision because it was the right thing to do to remove the tariffs, the right thing to protect all of our country, in, if you will, the economics, not just the steel industry. And it's a double-edged sword. I know that there are people in the steel industry in Gary who are still lucky to have a job at U.S. Steel, who are probably very concerned that the tariffs are gone.
And you're guessing they're not too happy tonight. John, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, how do you do the political calculus of this? They must have been up, all night in the White House trying to figure this out, because it could come down, who knows, to very closely sliced election. Those states, Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, maybe even Indiana, they really matter.
They do indeed. And the latest NPR poll has some interesting data on that. This is a poll that does the generic matchup, Bush versus an unnamed Democrat. In May, he was up 50% to 35. Now he's up only 44 to 41%. And the swing of that has been in swing states. All the move to the Democrats over this period has been in these states. It's gone from plus 19 for Bush in May to dead even today. So that shows you where he's got trouble in these swing states. Where he's been hemorrhaging. That's what's brought him down to 44, 41 nationally. He's held his own in the red states, and he's lost some, of course, in the Democratic states, but the biggest loss for him has been in the swing states.
And yet he made this move today. In part, we're told on the calculation that he couldn't afford to put Florida, South Carolina at risk.
Well, that's very true. I mean, it's this whole problem, the economic problem with protectionism, that if what you do at one point shows up someplace else as a problem, is also true politically, isn't it?
But Jack, what's your sense? Is protectionism a real option anymore? You know, we heard right here on the air tonight from another kind of manufacturer saying, look, that hurt me. We had to make all kinds of cutbacks. Can the United States really stand up, even for steelworkers, a symbol of industrial strength, and build a fence around them?
Well, it's very difficult in today's world with the WTO. I mean, Mr. Usher, the president of U.S. Steel, said it was pressure from the WTO. He blamed that for all this. We do surrender some of our sovereignty there. And that is something new under the sun, I mean, for the American economy. And there are winners and there are going to be losers. And I guess you just have to hope that they don't do, free trade in news analysts, or yours truly will be out of a job.
Well, they're brushing up their English skills right now somewhere in Western China, Jack. So watch out. We're talking tonight about American steel and the politics of protection with Gary Hufbauer, Peter Morici, and John Hinshaw. You can join the conversation as well. Is it worth saving steel jobs? If it costs auto jobs, medical instrumentation jobs, you can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American steel and the politics of protection. What do you think? Did President Bush make the right decision today on steel, dropping steel tariffs 16 months ahead of when he said he would? Is protectionism ever a good idea anymore? And were the tariffs bald vote buying by the White House or good management of an industry in trouble? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Alexandria, Virginia, by Peter Morici, professor of international business at the University of Maryland. From Washington, by Gary Hufbauer, senior fellow at the Institute of International Economics. And from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, by John Hinshaw, assistant professor of history at Lebanon Valley College. And right now, Fred's calling from Meadville, Pennsylvania. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Good evening.
Good evening. As I told the young lady, I'm a conductor on the Norfolk Southern Railroad Company.
Yeah.
And we deliver iron ore pallets to WCI out of Vice de Bueller to Warren, Ohio.
So you're delivering iron ore to the steel factory?
Right, the pellets for the melt. And I just wondered, they were on, they declared bankruptcy, and they evidently got a grant because they were only off for about 8 or 9 days, and then they resumed buying the pellets. I was wondering, this taking off the tariffs, I wonder what effect that's going to really bother them. It's rather a large plant and does hire and, you know, has quite a few people there.
Well, well, let's ask if our guests tonight know about it. John Hinshaw, do you know that particular plant?
I don't know that particular plant, but obviously it's going to put more pressure on the industry.
But we're hearing tonight, John, help me with this, that 80% of U.S. Steel consumption is from U.S. producers. Isn't that enough to keep this business afloat?
Well, I think... I'm sorry?
Yeah, one moment. John Hinshaw first. What's your thought?
Well, I think it's the industry, I mean, U.S. Steel today makes as much steel as it ever has. It does it with vastly fewer workers, right? And so at a certain point for the areas of western Pennsylvania, eastern Ohio, West Virginia, northwestern Indiana, it's still, you know, you still have places, and southwestern Pennsylvania is one of them, where they're still suffering a loss of population, where there's still young people are growing up, and they're not able to get jobs. And so, you know, that's... You know, and the more jobs are lost in steel, the more you're going to have layoffs in railroads. The more you're going to have layoffs in you know, at pizzerias down the corner.
So you're looking really at the culture in the regions where steel has been important, and saying, well, whatever the economics are, we've just got people who can't find a job or can't make a buck. They certainly can't make the $35, $36 an hour that they might in the steel business.
Tom, well, I'd like to leap in at some point, but
Well, let me get to Peter Morici first. Peter, what's your sense of this?
The issue keeps coming up that we make 80% of the steel we use. That is true. Before the tariffs were put in place, it's important to recognize that the price of imported steel was very low, and domestic prices were very low. They were really at an historic low, or at least, say, over the last 10 years. So it's not just the quantity of imports that's important. You know, it's also the price.
And what that competition does to price. Gary Huffpar, how about it? We've seen just bankruptcy after bankruptcy. It's become kind of endemic. I can't think of who hasn't gone bankrupt in the American steel industry. Is it so battered down and so key to the economy that at some point you've got to – they're right in crying, uncle?
Well, let me throw in a few statistics to back up what Professor Inhofe said. The steel industry 20 years ago employed about 500,000 production workers, and today it employs about 130,000. So it's actually a fairly small industry, especially compared to the steel-using industries. Now, there's various definitions of steel-using industries, but easily we're in the several million workers, even with a very narrow definition. So
that
the balance
sense.
Has completely shifted. Now, secondly, the bankruptcies were really driven, in my opinion, by the heavy pension loads and the unwillingness up to the time of bankruptcy of the United Steelworkers to adopt flexible work rules. And both of those factors have changed. I don't think it was principally the imports. It was the heavy financial load and the inefficient working practices. Now, those have both changed, and I don't think removing the tariffs is actually going to make noticeable difference. My estimate is only 3% change in price on account of the tariffs, and these other factors, the dollar, the recession, are so much larger than that in terms of the upside that I think the caller's job will be totally unaffected by this, though I do not know the specifics of the steel mill he was talking about.
But you think Fred's going to be able to continue to deliver iron ore most likely to the plant? And yet, Gary Huffpower, you know, you can hear the lament here that so many jobs have gone, and good-paying jobs, and in the same work rules that you may celebrate for their efficiency. Who knows? They might have made those workers' lives more comfortable. Are we saying...
Well, no doubt that's true, but that is the whole story of the American economy for at least 100 years and longer. The state of North Dakota, I mean, ask what's happened on the wheat fields. My old state of New Mexico, there are plenty of places in that state which are, you know, have a lot less population now because the kinds of agriculture which were once pursued are no longer pursued. Now,
big combines and not so many guys with pitchforks. Yeah.
Yeah, are we going to stop all this change or are we going to try to adapt to it? I don't think our public policies for adapting to it are anywhere near where they should be, but I think the direction ought to be clear that we adapt. We don't try to stop things in their stop in the tracks.
Not the blunderbuss of protectionism. Jeff is calling from Boston. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Good evening. I had 2 points, actually.
Yeah.
The first point I just wanted to mention briefly is that you talked about some of the things that might have been behind the decline or at least the stable growth rate of the steel industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the other contributing factors is probably the impact of substitute materials like plastic, composite, other metal alloys, which have substituted out for steel in certain applications.
Must be a factor.
Mm-hmm. And then the second point I just want to bring up is that one of the things I wonder is just listening to some of the changes that have happened in the steel industry since the tariffs were instituted. Some of those changes I don't think were structural from a business point of view, and I sort of wonder if the tariffs simply protected the steel industry from the from being buffeted by the gales of creative destruction that might have caused permanent bankruptcies of some of them, but at least would have enabled other players or the players that survived to operate the industry more efficiently.
So you're saying let it change or let it go and bring on the composites. Peter Morici, is that a realistic picture?
Well, I the fact that we have had substitution for steel is a fact, and it has reduced demand. But still, it's an industry that's vital, for example, to the automobile industry, and it has a future. For example, when Nissan's coming here this year to expand its production of SUVs and to introduce new models here, mm-hmm. it's using American steel as it moves here from Japan. It's not bringing Japanese steel with it. The real problem is more than just the legacy costs and so forth. Before the tariff, many mills such as Nucor were not able to recover their cost of capital. So it wasn't just the legacy cost, because the mini mills, by and large, don't have legacy costs. They don't have the United Steelworkers and so on. But prices had gotten so low that the viability of those plants was in the long term somewhat at jeopardy.
Just wasn't there. Our time's running down, but Gary Helfbauer, very quickly, 20 years from now, a U.S. steel industry or no? Will it all be done somewhere else?
Oh, sure. We'll have a steel industry. It'll be focused as Nucor already is, close to the customer. That's worth a lot, and Nucor is diversified right across the United States, as Peter said earlier, and so it'd be both close to the customer and then very high-tech steels, and it's sometimes forgotten, but the U.S. is an exporter of high-tech steels, just like we're an exporter of high-tech textiles. So I am quite confident that the steel industry will be with us 20 years from now.
Well, there's a picture, but the political tumblers have turned today. Gary Helfbauer with the Institute for International Economics, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Peter Morici at University of Maryland, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And John Hinshaw at Lebanon Valley College and joining us tonight from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Jack Beatty, there's a picture. There is not room for 500,000 steelworkers anymore, but specialty steel mills are going to be out there, and 80% still locally produced. Where does that leave us?
Well, the 80% really surprised me, which is heartening. These industries, workers in these industries are not only up against foreign competition, they're up against efficiency and productivity and the American genius for implementing that. And that makes it very hard for regions whose whole economy has been built around them. And Pennsylvania, unfortunately, for 20 years now, has been suffering from that.
Efficiency, too, has a price. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a moment. This is On Point. Police in Columbus, Ohio, announced today that there has been another shooting on Interstate Highway 270, where gunfire has hit at least 11 cars and one nearby school in recent weeks. There's no confirmation yet of whether this latest incident, which happened over the weekend, is linked to the other 12. The shootings have sent a chill through Ohio's capital, though. Residents have changed the route they drive to work, and some schools are holding recess indoors. Still, Columbus police have refused to use the word sniper to describe what seems to be a serial shooter in an apparent attempt to avoid the terror that gripped the Washington, D.C. area last year. Joe Blundo is one of many Columbus residents worried about the string of shootings. In this radio diary, he says what frightens him most is that it has taken so long for everyone to notice what's happening.
Well, I suppose there's no longer any reason to avoid the word sniper in the I-270 shootings. A dozen shootings, 11 vehicles and one school struck, one person dead. And now the police are saying they think all 12 incidents are linked. Police have made a point of not saying sniper, probably to avoid inciting panic. You know what? I would have been a little panicky even if all 12 shootings had been unconnected. We're talking about bullets flying randomly around a freeway, for heaven's sakes. It wouldn't have been comforting even if accidental. One of the more amazing aspects of this story is how nonchalant we've become about gunfire. We know now that bullets had been striking cars for weeks, but it took a fatality, the death of Gail Knisley, before anyone got too excited. After all, it was just gunfire. Happens all the time. In at least one case, the motorist whose car was struck didn't even report it to the police until much later. It was just gunfire. In another case, the police didn't bother to keep the bullet as evidence. They gave it to the motorist. Some keepsake, huh? Not that flying bullets are a new phenomenon. They've been whining around some crime-prone neighborhoods in Columbus for years. Houses are struck by gunfire every day, without making the news. For that matter, so are people. A flesh wound won't guarantee you ink or airtime in this town, or many others, unless the circumstances are unusual. That's how nonchalant we are about flying bullets. Most of the time, it's easy to pretend that this situation doesn't exist. A lot of us are lucky enough to live in neighborhoods where gunfire isn't common. Then comes something like the I-270 shootings to intrude on our sense of safety. Suddenly, the notion of being killed for no reason on the way home from work becomes a less remote possibility. Yes, the idea of one malicious shooter lurking near I-270 does seem more threatening than bullets flying for who knows what reason in a city neighborhood. But you would think we'd find either situation an intolerable emergency. For some reason, we don't. It takes a sniper to get us excited. A violence problem this severe should unite people across the political spectrum, but all it seems to do is send them fleeing to absolutist camps. Pro-gun, anti-gun. I'm no expert, but I'm pretty sure that we can expect no help from either side. Absolutists make noise, not progress. I think I'll start a new political action group, People Against Getting Shot. Our one issue would be this. We're for anything that reduces our risk of getting shot. Any politicians who want our support, and I would think we'd be an enormous group given our platform, must prove that their positions will not increase our risk of getting shot. Meanwhile, there's a decision to make. Drive on I-270 South or not. I'll probably still risk it. The odds of being the unlucky one are low, and the police scrutiny is high. Besides, I'm not as fearful of that road as I am of a society that normally finds it pretty easy to yawn at the sound of whizzing bullets.
Joe Blundo is a columnist for the Columbus Dispatch. He's lived in Columbus, Ohio for the last 25 years. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. How are events in the news affecting you personally? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org, or mail us your radio diary. The address is On Point, WBUR Boston, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.